from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from an impossibly hot London, England, you know, the power that radio has to affect radio is really negligible. Last week on this broadcast, I talked to you about NPR advertising for a new ombudsman. You know what that is. And the interesting choice in two different places in the ad for, you know, looking for applicants for the job, that the job description did not include, specifically excluded, passing of judgment or making comments on NPR's journalism. Well, the reverberations were felt all the way from my left arm to my right arm. But the very next day, Jay Rosen, a blogger on journalism, who teaches journalism at NYU, brought up the very same points, raised the very same questions. And I guess a lot of folks in public radio read him. And so we now have this. National Public Radio is backing away from a revised job description for its ombudsman that suggested the person in the position should avoid passing judgment on any errors in NPR news coverage. NPR calls that listing, quote, a mistake, unquote. Following the criticism by Rosen that NPR had, quote, downgraded the ombudsman position, NPR's new CEO, Jarl Mohn, issued a statement to the Media Matters website, calling the language a mistake. Quoting Mohn's statement, the ombudsman must be fully independent and fully transparent in order to do their job. Nice agreement of subject and referent, do their job on behalf of the public. The language in the current job description about not providing commentary or passing judgment is a mistake, and we are removing it. I take this position very seriously, unquote. Several NPR member stations had expressed concerns to Media Matters about the apparent reduction in the power of the ombudsman. They never had judgment restriction before, and they made a point. They used that phrase twice. They did it twice, said Ellen Rocco, North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and a former NPR board member. That's what's worrying a number of my colleagues in the system. Trust is NPR's calling card. Absolutely what we care about more than anything else. And you cannot have trust without transparency. And part of transparency in the case of an ombudsman is the right to say what they in good faith come to a conclusion, doing an impartial analysis of the work being done by NPR. Who wouldn't want that? We all want to be better. We want to do the job righter and righter, unquote. Former board member of NPR. No one, aside from your humble host, has yet asked what kind of mistake, made by whom, approved by whom, could put the language in two different places in the ad. Jay Rosen will get to it. When you want to hear what an ombudsman can do, here's an analysis by NPR's current ombudsman of a story regarding 5-Hour Energy on All Things Considered a couple of years ago. When the host drank a bottle of it, several listeners were not entertained. His interview that followed were a conflict of interest and violated NPR's new ethics code. They, the listeners, said, since the company that makes the drink, Living Essentials, is an NPR corporate sponsor. Quoting now the ombudsman, the segment did not need to acknowledge that Living Essentials is a sponsor. Hardly any story on a company that is a sponsor should. This is the current ombudsman, ladies and gentlemen. The new ethics handbook does indeed require such disclosure, but the handbook should be revised. The revision is now underway. You either trust NPR's reporters and editors to be impartial or you don't. As a former editor and publisher, I know that some realism is required here. There's no way to totally eliminate the appearance of all conflicts of interest, and sometimes the conflict itself. Any system comes down at some point to trust. You either trust NPR's reporters and editors to be impartial, or you don't. Near the end of the ombudsman report on the story about 5-Hour Energy, and why the health risks of such drinks were not included in the story, the ombudsman says, "The purpose of the firewall is to hold in check the influence our funders have over our journalism." I asked the producer of the segment why the health risks weren't mentioned in the segment. His response, quote, "I think the simple answer is you can't include every single angle in one conversation. The interview was about the man and the business more than the health pros and cons of the product itself. That's a different conversation altogether." Continuing, "Considering that the story was based on an article that ran in Forbes magazine and the interview was with the reporter, not with someone from the company, the explanation is defensible," concludes the NPR ombudsman. Yes, if you're not doing original reporting, if you're just interviewing a reporter who did the story, then you don't have to mention the health risks. But wait, there's more. Because now it's time for me to read the trades for you. From Current, the trade publication of Public Broadcasting, "Possibility of native ads on public radio sparks concern." Will I read it for you? Does the Pope have lips? Dateline Denver. "A public radio station's foray into native advertising, which seamlessly integrates paid content into a website's editorial fare, stirred strong opinions earlier this month. Attendees at the Public Media Development and Marketing Conference packed the room to hear plans for a native advertising." It's not what you think. "On the site of Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena, home of KPCC. The broadcaster received a $33,000 grant a couple months ago from the Knight Foundation and the Investigative News Network to experiment with native advertising." Not what you think. It's also known as sponsored content. "Over the six-month pilot stage, SCPR, the Southern California Public Radio, will develop a native advertising framework for online and mobile platforms. We believe that the framework emerging from this grant will map out the common ground between the interests of the audience, underwriters, and journalistic principles." That's what Southern California Public Radio told the Investigative News Network. According to the Interactive Advertising Bureau, native advertising encompasses paid ads that are so cohesive with the page content, assimilated into the design, and consistent with the platform behavior, that the viewer simply feels that they belong. I believe they mean the ads, not the viewer. "Such advertising provides an innovative way to bring in new revenue," says Southern California Public Radio Digital Media Director Alex Shaffert Callahan. "It's all about striking a balance," she said. "Digital ads make up about 10% of Southern California Public Radio's underwriting revenue. That does not a business model for the future make," Callahan said. "So we have to shake things up a little bit. We have to innovate a little bit, but not to the point where we're damaging our credibility," unquote. Harry Clark, general manager of corporate underwriting and integrated media sponsorships at New York Public Radio, said the station has been approached about native advertising. Audiences, he says, are intelligent enough to discern sponsored content from other content. This feature brought to you by Enron. Advertisers are not trying to hoodwink the audience, Clark said, but are rather looking for a way to leverage the goodwill stations have with listeners and viewers. Others at the session sounded a more cautionary note. Native advertising has huge potential to undermine public media's reputation, said the vice president of news and public affairs at Oregon Public Broadcasting. One thing we don't want to lose sight of is the core value of trust. Morgan Holm said, if podcasters start blurring lines and cause audience members to wonder about who wrote or signed off on ads, we might lose some trust. Because online advertising is not subject to FCC regulations, theoretically, said Holm, we can do whatever we want. The question is, should we? Holm also cautioned that native advertising might make listeners feel less essential to stations' fundraising efforts. Quote, we spend a lot of time on the air telling the audience it's their support that keeps us going. Do we really want to monkey with that? Unquote. John Barth, managing director of the Public Radio Exchange, where stations get some of their programming, warned colleagues about native advertising, which he said was discussed at AOL when he worked there. Be extremely careful, he said. You think you're playing with a new toy that'll generate revenue. It sure will. And at the end of that pipe is a real danger with the audience. Our job, he said, is to make sure journalism and news is in a pure space. Unquote. More purity for you, also from Current. New digital offerings from NPR aim to give public media additional platforms for building online audiences while gaining insights into how listeners and viewers interact with digital content. NPR's long-awaited NPR One app, were demonstrated during that public media conference. The NPR mobile app has had a lot of names during its development process. Project Carbon, Infinite Player, and MPX. The name NPR One is now locked in. The app will be released in a soft launch later this month. Using an algorithm and user feedback to create an audio stream fusing NPR content with newscasts and segments provided by local stations. In playback mode, the app rolls a welcome message and station ID before launching the stream. Listeners can indicate which segments they like, and the algorithm will tailor content to their preferences. You like more interviews with the guy who interviewed the guy at the energy beverage company? You got it. The content stream will include national sponsorship credits and prompts to donate to stations. An affirmative response will send users to a station's pledge page. Only stations that buy services from NPR Digital Services will be represented on NPR One. The app is a work in progress, says the general manager of St. Louis Public Radio, quote, this thing is full of minefields we're all going to have to work through. We're going to have to work through it as a system. One problem he cited is the app's limitation on segment length. It can only handle pieces of roughly 5 minutes. That cap might discourage stations from producing longer pieces, he said. Sounding more like commercial radio every day? We're disrupting ourselves, said John Davido, GM of Boston's public radio station WBUR. But otherwise, we do it or someone else is going to come along and eat our lunch. In addition to providing a means for growing digital audiences, NPR One will provide opportunities for gathering data about listener habits. Stations now have little insight into how listeners are using audio. Online platforms allow listeners to access a good percentage of public radio content, said Vice President for Digital Media at KQED in San Francisco, and we don't know anything about the people using it. More data, ladies and gentlemen, about that pure space between your ears. Hello, welcome to the show.
Summer is a sizzler, sweat pouring down your face. Your armpits are a fountain. Your shirt's a wet disgrace. And it's hard to sleep at nighttime. Can't walk the streets by day. 4 months in the hot box. Just one thing I can say. You may see me moving slowly, but you won't hear me moan. 'Cause heat is only skin deep. Cold is to the bone. Cold is to the bone. Winter's clean and brittle. Humidity's all gone. You can ski and you can snowboard. Weather's got it going on. But to keep blood circulating, you wear 50 pounds of stuff. Get your gloves or layers. You're a dead man soon enough. I can see my breath before me. Got to be a rolling stone. This heat is only skin deep. Cold is to the bone. Is to the bone. Cold is to the bone. Cold is to the bone.
From London, England, where we don't need no stinking air conditioning. We will soon. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now,
I had a secret that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret became impatient to be free. And my secret's no secret anymore.
News of secrets, ladies and gentlemen. Secrets no more. This week, we learned that a group of, I believe, six detainees being held in Guantanamo Bay. The worst of the worst, we were told. The worst of the worst is what's there. These six are being sent to Uruguay, has agreed to take them. One of the problems with the detainees is that in many cases they can't be sent back to their home countries, which regard them as a threat. So the United States needs to find some place to put them, not in the United States. So these are sent to Uruguay. This group would be the largest to depart Guantanamo at once since 2009. The transfer would reduce the Guantanamo Bay inmate population to 143. That figure includes 72 prisoners recommended for release and 71 who are not. So more than half of the worst of the worst being held in Guantanamo are, by the standards of the United States government, innocent of anything and should be released. But we can't find a place to put them. How about shooting them into space? How about burying them with atomic waste? The secretive British spy agency, GCHQ, has developed covert tools to seed the internet with false information, including the ability to manipulate the results of online polls, according to the Intercept website. Just one more reason to believe in polls, I guess. They can artificially inflate page view counts on websites. This would explain the Kardashians, perhaps. amplify approved messages on YouTube, and censor video content judged to be extremist. These capabilities, detailed in the documents provided by Edward Snowden, even include a way to connect two unsuspecting phone users together in a call, with one of them being a fan of Howard Stern, I would think. The tools were created by British intelligence, its Joint Threat Research Intelligence Group, the JTRIG, and constitute some of the most standout methods of propaganda and internet deception contained within the Snowden archive. The code names include, to change the outcome of online polls, a tool called Underpass, mass delivery of email messaging to support an information ops campaign, Badger, and mass delivery of SMS or text messages to support an information ops campaign, Warpath. Disruption of video-based websites hosting extremist content, Silverlord. Active Skype capability, real-time call records, Skype Out, and bidirectional instant messaging. Miniature Hero. Find private photographs of targets on Facebook, Spring Bishop, a tool that will permanently disable a target's account on their computer, Angry Pirate. Ability to artificially increase traffic to a website, Gateway. And ability to inflate page views on website, Slipstream. But you didn't hear about this here. Oh, and you may recall last week on this broadcast, we discussed the fact that records for U.S. extraordinary rendition flights taking persons unknown to black CIA prisons or to other countries where they could be interrogated more robustly. These flight records for the British island of Diego Garcia had been rendered unreadable by water damage. Well, this week we find out they've dried out. Seriously. The UK government now says days after it was revealed the logs were ruined by water damage, they've dried out. The Foreign Office was accused of a cover-up after ministers admitted there were limited records of flights landing and taking off on Diego Garcia starting in 2002, adding they understood they were incomplete due to water damage. The U.S. has previously admitted using Diego Garcia, but not the Brits. But now Foreign Office Minister Mark Simmons says a fuller inspection from immigration officials on the island has revealed previously wet paper records have been dried out, so they have the technology. He added the officials report no flight records have been lost as a result of water damage. So maybe they'll get to the bottom of how the Brits allowed the Americans to use Diego Garcia to do some extraordinary rendition. And finally, on the secrecy front, German politicians are considering a return to using manual typewriters for sensitive documents in the wake of a scandal involving U.S. spying on Germany. Well, what do they want? They lost the war. The head of the Bundestag's parliamentary inquiry into NSA activity in Germany said in a TV interview that he and his colleagues are seriously thinking of getting out of email altogether. Asked, "Are you considering typewriters?" by the interviewer, the politician Patrick Sundberg said, "As a matter of fact, we have, and not electronic models either." "Really?" the interviewer asked. "Yes, no joke," Sundberg responded. Last year, the Russian government reportedly took similar measures after the extent of U.S. electronic surveillance was revealed by Edward Snowden. The Federal Guard Service, a powerful body tasked with protecting Russia's highest-ranking officials, this is according to the Guardian newspaper, put in an order for 20 Triumph Adler typewriters, which create unique handwriting that allows the source of any documents created on them to be traced. Back in Germany, the Die Welt newspaper writes, "People are trying to stay away from technology whenever they can. Those concerned talk less on the phone, prefer to meet in person. More coffees are being drunk and lunches eaten together. Even the walk in the park is increasingly enjoying a revival," unquote. Better for the spy movies, don't you think? Never thought I'd hear this music again, so buy typewriter stock. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In a hurry, like you would be, to finish installations for Afghan forces before the end of the year, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is leaving behind hundreds of buildings that were built with materials that make them prone to catch fire. That's according to the Inspector General with oversight over the U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan, reported this week. That fact alone alarmed John Sopko, the Inspector General. But he was incensed by the rationale offered by one Army general who said the military was unable to retrofit all of the buildings. Quote, "The typical occupant populations for these facilities are young, fit Afghan soldiers and recruits who have the physical ability to make a hasty retreat during a developing situation," unquote, Major General Michael Eyre, commander of the Army Corps' Transatlantic Division. IG Sopko criticized the Army Corps for leaving behind unsafe buildings and for the money it has had to spend upgrading others. Quote, "I'm very troubled by such logic, which seems to argue that fire hazards for a building are somehow remedied by the youthful speed and vigor of the occupants," he wrote in a letter. "This logic pales in light of not only the speed with which these buildings will be consumed by fire, as well as the fact that a number of the buildings in question are infirmaries and sleeping quarters," unquote. The fire-prone buildings are among 1,600 structures the Army was commissioned to build at military bases around the country as part of a $1.5 billion effort. Of those, only 507 were initially built using materials that meet a global safety standard. The Army is taking steps to make fixes to 800 of the facilities, but it expects that 285 will remain non-compliant because of the type of insulation foam that contractors installed in the buildings. Two of the buildings were engulfed in flames quickly while they were built. Army officials said those cases were the result of, quote, "hot work by the contractor," or the contractor, unquote. Hot work. Give me some hot work tonight, baby. The Office of the Inspector General first raised concerns about the buildings more than a year ago, calling the use of spray polyurethane foam insulation systems a significant fire hazard. Later that month, Army officials agreed to cease using the installation foam in new buildings. But early this year, Army officials began transferring buildings that were built with the deficient materials over to the Afghans, citing the urgency of finishing the installations for a force that has taken the brunt of the fight. The threat of fire at Afghan military bases is high because they often get attacked with artillery, and many have power grids or generators that deliver unsteady electricity. The Corps' apparent failure to enforce its own contract requirements seems to have resulted in tens of millions of dollars in additional costs and significant construction delays, said the IG. "Moreover, I'm concerned that the rush to complete these buildings has led the Corps of Engineers to disregard its own safety standards, and in so doing has jeopardized the lives of Afghan soldiers." The 285 buildings that will remain non-compliant include 4 medical clinics and 2 fire stations. Master of irony, the Inspector General. And the Justice Department and the FBI delayed notifying prosecutors in scores of death row convictions that their cases may have relied on flawed FBI forensic work. That's according to the Justice Department's Inspector General. In a scathing report that shed new light on one of the FBI lab's worst modern scandals, the IG said the Justice Department didn't properly review all of the cases by FBI examiners whose work was known to be flawed. The report said the FBI took more than 5 years to identify more than 60 death row defendants whose cases had been handled by the 13 lab examiners whose work had been criticized in an inspector general investigation in 1997. As a result, state authorities couldn't consider whether to stay the sentences, and 3 men were put to death. News from the Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And you've been hearing, we all have, about fines just this week or last week. The federal government announced a $7 billion fine against Citibank, which our friend Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism reckons is no more than $4 billion in cash and $3 million in stuff they would have done anyway. And we've heard about Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase, but what's happening at Goldman Sachs? Well, it's been fined $800,000 by a U.S. regulator for failing to ensure that that trades in its dark pool took place at the best prices. Dark pools are places where large institutions can trade stocks off the stock exchange so that the trading prices are not public knowledge. Good idea, don't you think? The regulator said more than 395,000 trades were executed in the bank's Sigma X dark pool at an inferior price during an eight-day period 3 years ago. It added that Goldman was unaware of the issue at the time. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority alleged that Goldman Sachs failed to establish, maintain, and enforce written policies and procedures that were reasonably designed to prevent trades from being executed at inferior prices. Of course, if they're executed at an inferior price, that means somebody on the other side of the deal got a superior price, don't it? Goldman Sachs and 10 other companies were fined $302 million by European competition authorities this year for running a secret cartel to block competition in the market for electricity power cables. Documents filtering out of a parliamentary inquiry in Portugal found their way to the Independent newspaper in London this week, with an example of one financial expert describes as possibly the most stupidly complicated financial transaction ever sold. Basically, a Portuguese state-owned train and subway company, Metro do Porto, bought a swap deal sold by a team of London-based bankers at Goldman Sachs. The deal was so toxic that far from saving millions of euros, which was the goal, in less than a year, Metro do Porto ended up owing Goldman millions. The devastating civil war that's ravaged Libya has undoubtedly altered the power structure of the North African nation. It's also revealed, according to Forbes, that major U.S. and European financial firms, including Goldman Sachs, actively courted executives of the Libyan Investment Authority, which, flush with $60 billion of the nation's oil profits, paid rich fees to invest with Western banks and funds, in some cases losing their whole investment. Now the Libyan Investment Authority is suing Goldman Sachs. Starting out with $1.3 billion, the positions acquired between January and June of 2008 saw their value decimated, falling to $25 million by February of 2010. Goldman dismisses the accusations as without merit. And late last year, Goldman Sachs gave Hillary Clinton almost $500,000 for two speeches in 1 week. The speech was described as prepared remarks, followed by limited questions. One was a closed-door meeting with Goldman and its clients. The prior Tuesday, she spoke at a session hosted by Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, who once described his firm as doing, quote, God's work, unquote. He's an ironic god, isn't he?
When Mr. Goldman met Mr. Sachs, business ran on railroad tracks. The world was simpler, you can't forget, when Mr. Sachs and Goldman met. Said Mr. Goldman, for years and years, our guys have got the most between the ears. Said Mr. Sachs, let's unhook the reins and find new ways to profit off our traders' brains. Clinton Sack.
got it covered. Go back to bed.
Hank Paulson's our man, Mr. Sacks recalled. We may get a haircut, but we won't go bald. Any bailout rules will be comfy and lax. Mr. Goldman was reassured by Mr. Sacks.
From London, this is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen,
soft, listen to the war. We can listen to the war.
Makes him tremble just to think about it. A new look at the vital signs of Earth's climate reveals a stark picture of declining health. As global temperatures rise, so does sea level and the amount of heat trapped in the ocean's upper layers. Meanwhile, mountain glaciers and Arctic sea ice are melting away beneath an atmosphere where concentrations of three key planet-warming greenhouse gases continue to rise. This, according to Science magazine. Yeah, science. Quote, data show that the climate is changing more rapidly now than it has at any time in the historical record. Unquote, Thomas Carl, director of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's National Climatic Data Center. The numbers, he says, speak for themselves. The numbers speak pretty loudly depending on which data set scientists look at. 2013 falls somewhere between the second warmest and sixth warmest year since record keeping began in 1880. Global sea level reached a new record high last year, about 3.8 centimeters above the average measured by satellites between 93 and 2010. Overall sea level is rising about 3 millimeters, 1/8 of an inch each year. And for the 23rd straight year, mountain glaciers on the whole lost more ice than they gained. The new study, State of the Climate in 2013, was released in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. The detailed peer-reviewed analysis was based on data from environmental monitoring stations on land, sea, and ice, and from sensors on satellites and planes. More than 400 scientists from 57 countries contributed to the report. Increases in the levels of three key greenhouse gases are likely to be the root of recent warming, the scientists suggest. The average global concentration of CO2 reached more than 395 parts per million, a 2.8 parts per million increase over the previous year. Levels of both methane and nitrous oxide, which on a pound-for-pound basis trap heat more effectively than CO2, rose last year about 0.3%. This is a big conspiracy, reporting this. Lots of conspirators. About two-thirds of the atmosphere's heat-trapping power comes from CO2, which is much more prevalent than the other gases. From pole to pole, few parts of the globe are being spared warm-up. In the Eurasian Arctic, average temperatures last summer ranged between 1 and 3 degrees Celsius warmer than the average from 2007 through 2012. Fairbanks, Alaska, had a record number of days in which the daily high temperature reached 80 degrees Fahrenheit. All that warmth is seeping into the ground. Permafrost temperatures measured 20 meters below ground at many sites in Alaska reached record highs last year. And 2013's Arctic sea ice coverage in September, the month it usually falls to its lowest for the year, was 18% below the average coverage for that month from 1981 through 2010. And the rate at which Earth's groundwater reservoirs are being depleted is constantly increasing. Annual groundwater depletion during the first decade of the century was twice as high as it was between 1960 and 2000. USA, India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and China are the countries with the highest rates of groundwater depletion. About 15% of global groundwater consumption is not sustainable. On the Arabian Peninsula, in Libya, Egypt, Mali, Mozambique, and Mongolia, over 30% of groundwater consumption is from non-renewable groundwater. The new estimate of global groundwater depletion is 113,000 million cubic meters per year for the period 2000 to 2009, which is lower than previous widely varying estimates. This is the now most reliable value to date, according to Science Daily. The increased use of groundwater for irrigation also results in a rise in sea levels. Sea level rise due to groundwater depletion, according to calculations, was 0.31 millimeters per year during the period from 2000 to 2009, one-tenth of the total sea level rise. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe.
Our friend Addy the Atom, you're looking a little kind of heat stressed.
Well, I can't hydrate, can I?
I don't know. I don't know your atomic structure. Constellation Energy Nuclear Group, a joint venture between Exelon and EDF of France, filed a petition with the New York State Public Service Commission to keep the R.E. Ginna nuclear plant in Ontario, New York, operating. It's been struggling to make ends meet for some time. The facility lost money in 2011, and its cumulative losses in 2012-2013 totaled nearly $100 million when allocation for corporate overhead is included. The plant had been operating under a purchase power agreement with Rochester Gas and Electric for a majority of its output until the agreement expired. Now, the facility operates as a fully merchant generator, according to PowerMag.com, in the wholesale market. But energy and capacity sales on the New York grid may not be expected to cover the cost of continuing plant operations. Similar situations led to the closure of the Kewaunee power station last year and the planned shuttering of Vermont Yankee. Your thoughts?
It's the damn market. I blame the market. Market's screwing up.
The immense waters of the Great Lakes will greatly dilute any radiation-bearing water that might leak from a proposed nuclear waste site on Lake Huron, says an expert group, according to the Toronto Star. Free-flowing, fast-flowing surface water would also dilute leaking radiation should the site be located in the ancient rock of the Canadian Shield, says the group. The four-member group has filed a report with the federal panel examining around Ontario Power's proposal to bury low- and intermediate-level nuclear waste in a limestone formation below the surface on the shore of Lake Huron.
So dilution is the solution to pollution.
Wow, look at you.
No, don't. I'm hot. I'm sweating.
Adam Sweat. Bolts that failed by the dozen inside four Salem Unit 2 nuclear reactor coolant pumps. This is in the Delaware area. Idling the plant for months. That failure. Those bolts were made of a metal alloy deemed unsuitable for nuclear reactors as long ago as 1984, according to the Industry and Nuclear Regulatory Commission filings. Manufacturer Westinghouse, you can't be sure because it's owned by Toshiba now.
You can be sure.
Determined that parts loosened by bolt failures could have created a substantial safety hazard at the plant along the Delaware River had they suddenly locked up rapidly spinning parts in one or more of the 30-foot-tall coolant pumps, according to the NRC spokesperson. Westinghouse considered the pump freeze-up extremely unlikely.
You can take that to the bank. Toshiba Bank, though.
It considered it prudent to formally report the bolt issue. The Westinghouse notification revealed additional details about the severity of the problem inside the pumps. In three of the four, large metal assemblies that redirect water flows dropped from their regular positions just above water-moving impellers. When the bolts broke or sheared off in two of those three pumps, the fusers made contact with the impellers, which spin at thousands of rotations per minute.
You don't want your diffusers hanging with your impellers.
Brookhaven National Laboratory concluded in 1984 that the metals used in these type of bolts should not be used as a reactor structural material because of its susceptibility to damaging changes under high stress and temperatures. Reactor designer Babcock and Wilcox removed the alloy from its designs that year. The same concerns were noted in NRC notifications to industry during the 90s. Full details on the damage and cost of the repairs and shutdown have yet to be released.
I'm sure it's cheap.
I am too. I trust you. A leaking safety valve at SCE&G's nuclear power plant in South Carolina, northwest of Columbia, is expected to keep the plant shut down for up to 2 weeks as the utility works to make repairs. The company said the leak isn't a danger to the public.
None of them are. None of them is. I don't know how those agree, but...
Glad you're even thinking about that. Nuclear Matters, an industry-funded group chaired by former Senators Evan Bayh, Democrat of Indiana, Judd Gregg, Republican of New Hampshire, is taking a pro-nuclear power message to Congress and the American people. Others in the group include President Clinton's former EPA Administrator Carol Browner and President Bush's Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham.
Sounds like an interested but independent group.
It does, until you realize Nuclear Matters is funded by several energy companies, including Dominion Resources, Exelon, PG&E, Francis Areva, and the aforementioned Westinghouse.
Somebody's got to pay for their phone bill.
Even before a radiation leak in February halted the flow of nuclear waste to the waste isolation power plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico, the federal government had identified deficiencies in Los Alamos National Laboratory's safeguards against potentially catastrophic nuclear fission accidents. That's according to a new report that's reported in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. Los Alamos, quote, does not meet expectations in overall performance of its criticality safety program, according to the report. The calendar year review for 2013 assessed safety measures throughout the national nuclear defense complex, identifying Los Alamos as the lone site with inadequate but improving performance. Los Alamos was one of only two where the criticality safety program was inadequately staffed. But the staff is at an all-time high. So...
if you didn't die already.
Yes. The lab instituted a mentoring program with experienced criticality safety professionals instructing new hires about hazards and has relied on subcontractors to fill some roles. Root causes of Los Alamos' deficiencies identified in the report include... unclear documentation.
That's not nuclear documentation misspelled, is it?
No. And understanding of roles, responsibilities, authority, and accountability at the lab. And its management has not yet fully embraced its commitment to criticality, safety, self-discovery, communication to the worker, and continuous improvement.
They're critical about criticality.
Bingo. Dateline Oconee County, South Carolina, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has set up a conference to discuss an apparent violation in procedures at the Oconee nuclear station that allowed an undetected crack to leak and force a shutdown.
Lacks lead to cracks lead to creeks. It leaks.
Clean, cheap, safe to profound Demeter, our friend the Atom.
We're so sorry.
Now a quick potpourri of this week's apologies of the week. The Hudson Project has apologized to its fans in a lengthy Facebook post for the way some of the festival in Saugerties, New York, home of the original Woodstock Festival, was handled, especially during the weekend storm that ended up canceling the event. CNN has removed correspondent Diana Magne from covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict after she tweeted that the Israelis who were cheering the bombing of Gaza and who had allegedly threatened her were, quote, scum. She deeply regrets the language used, which was aimed directly at those who had been targeting our crew. She and CNN apologize for any offense that may have been taken, said the CNN statement. Actor Eric Roberts has apologized for saying Bakersfield sucks. He was interviewed in Bakersfield on the set of the faith-based film Revelations. He wasn't kind when asked when he thought about Bakersfield, but then tweeted, I really owe you an apology, Bakersfield. I loved being there every time I've shot there, especially in faith-based movies. In a dramatic turnaround from policy created and enforced 3 years ago, Google has now reversed its real names policy on Google Plus. The company announced there are no more restrictions on what name you can use. A post Tuesday afternoon on Google's own Plus account apologized for the policy, saying there are no more restrictions on what name you can use. We apologize. We hope that today's change is a step toward making Google Plus the welcoming and inclusive place that we want it to be, unquote, so we can get more of your data. A London lawyer complained he bought a candy bar with a penis-like shape imprinted on it. Nestle has apologized. Enough said. They thought it was shaped like a horse's head. The actor who sparked public outrage months ago about flight MH370 has done it again, this time about the latest Malaysian Airlines disaster. A series of tweets by actor Jason Biggs has caused outrage on social media. He's now apologized. People were offended, and that was not my intent. Sorry to those of you that were sending positive thoughts to the victims and their families, he tweeted. Major League Baseball apologized Tuesday for a late-night fireworks display at an All-Star Gala in downtown Minneapolis that was louder and more illuminating than initially advertised and that started later than it was supposed to, leaving many Minneapolis residents sleepy and irritated, don't you know? Philadelphia mayor is apologizing for profanity used by rapper Nicki Minaj and comedian Marlon Wayans during a family-friendly July 4th concert. A hidden camera was discovered recently in a bathroom at Cleveland TV station WEWS, a first-floor men's room trying to deal with an apparent vandalism problem. The management has apologized. And those are the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet of Mighty 104 in Berlin, available via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org, available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from WWNO.org and iTunes and Sideshow Network and SoundCloud. And if you just like fixing those leaks, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO in New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. I'm on Twitter at the Harry Shearer. Are you? The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from a muggy London.